Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Alan Vanook from the University of California at San Francisco, and to begin, he commented on research presented at the plenary session of the ASCO meeting last June, focusing on the duration of adjuvant chemotherapy for colon cancer.
So this was called the IDEA, I-D-E-A. It was a pooled analysis of six trials done across the world in six different countries or parts of the world. Fundamentally, each of them looked at 6 versus 3 months of an oxaliplatin-based regimen. And as you said, the real key is if you can get away with 6 cycles or 3 months of oxaliplatin versus 6 months, you'll have much less neuropathy and make a big difference in patient quality of life. And really, there are almost no examples where you need that much therapy to cure people with adjuvant treatment. So the design was basically leave the specifics to the different groups, so the 6 different groups, and then pool the data in a pre-planned analysis. Dan Sargent, one of the giants of biostatistics in cancer, actually engineered all of this. Unfortunately, he passed away suddenly before it came to fruition. At the end of the day, clearly, I think, there was very little difference in survival between patients who got 3 or 6 months. And when you looked at the subsets of patients, and these are big subsets because it's almost 12,000 patients, what you see is that patients with a low-risk disease, N1 or fewer than 4 lymph nodes, for example, not T4, those patients clearly did not lose any survival benefit from the adjuvant therapy if they got just 3 months of oxali. The higher-risk patients, it's less clear, and probably most of us would say try to give 6 months of adjuvant oxali, but you'd back down when the oxaliplatin neuropathy begins. A much tougher nut to crack is whether the chemotherapy mattered, and some people look at the data, and in fact, it does appear in Europe that capecitabine CAPOX patients did better than FOLFOX patients, and that's really hard to square. In the U.S., we don't use much capecitabine because the dosing is more poorly tolerated in the U.S. than in Europe. A lot of speculation why that is. So some people would say, well, CAPOX is a better adjuvant treatment than FOLFOX. Again, in this case, though, it wasn't a randomized study, CAPOX versus FOLFOX, in any of these countries. It was dealer's choice, physician's choice. So for all of the 12,800 patients or whatever that were included in this big consortium pooled analysis, at the end of the day, I think we can say probably that patients with low-risk stage 3 colon cancer do fine with 3 months of oxaliplatin, and those with higher risk should get more, if not up to 6 months of oxaliplatin.
So in your own clinical practice outside a trial setting, how do you define high risk where you start thinking about 6 months?
Yeah, so to me, one of the most important things is the percentage of nodes. So let's say if you have more than 4 nodes by the parameters that they used in this study, that would have qualified as a high risk. Now, the high risk patients were a little underrepresented compared to the standard risk or low risk patients as we usually define them. And that's undoubtedly because the doctors who were putting patients on the study, if they had somebody with, 12, 15, 20 positive lymph nodes, they probably didn't include them on the study because they didn't think they could get away with less chemotherapy. That's my guess. But my view is that patients who certainly have fewer than 4 nodes, patients with a lot of nodes, let's say 20, 30, 40 nodes with 1 or 2 positive, those are patients I would lean more towards 3 months. I think at the same time, you can easily justify in patients who are at 6 cycles or 3 months of oxaliplatin who have no toxicity at all, perfectly reasonable to say, well, let's keep going until we start to get some semblance of neurotoxicity and then we'll stop. I mean, I think it's a continuum. The study didn't do what we do in practice, which is you stop the oxaliplatin when the neuropathy persists between cycles and then continue the 5-FU alone. That would have been way more complex, way more patients, but we would have at least addressed it the way we actually do it clinically.
So as you say, all these studies and all the data were really complex, the discussions that went on about this. One of the things that came up that I was kind of surprised at, well, I didn't realize it, that I guess the common CAPOX regimens, you get more oxali in earlier than with FOLFOX?
That is technically true. The oxaliplatin in CAPOX, or CAPOX, it's every 3 weeks oxaliplatin, and it's, I think, 135 milligrams per meter squared compared to 85 milligrams per meter squared in the every other weekly oxali of FOLFOX. Over the course of the 6 cycles of FOLFOX or 4 cycles of CAPOX, which would constitute 3 months, you get almost the identical amount of oxaliplatin. I mean, it's pretty hard to know if it is true that you sort of front-load the oxaliplatin. So Let's say you've got 270 milligrams of oxali within the first 3 weeks in a day, right? So you treat, then you take 3 weeks off, then you treat again. And so there's a little more dose up front in oxali compared to the FOLFOX regimen. Whether that's meaningful or not, whether the early hit of chemotherapy matters, if it does, maybe that makes a difference. It's really hard to square that, and it'd be hard to figure that out.
In your own practice, do you use FOLFOX or CAPOX?
We reuse very little capecitabine. Again, the flaw in the whole analysis as it applies to the U.S. patients is it's well documented that capecitabine is not as well tolerated in the U.S. So in the studies with CAPOX, the dose that's used of capecitabine is just not a dose we can use in the U.S. when you combine it with oxali. So if you cut it by 100 or 150 milligram per meter squared, are you losing efficacy? We don't know, but that's our concern. So most of us do not use CAPE. Now, some people look at this data and say, you know, this is evidence we should be using capecitabine and push it. Perfectly reasonable to do. I myself worry about getting too much toxicity in adjuvant therapy and throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, if patients get too sick and can't complete the therapy, then I don't know, you've done them a favor.
So another very practical issue that really only has come on the scene relatively recently in colon cancer is the issue of sidedness. You've been involved with the research. There's been a lot of work that's been published in the last couple of years. Can you kind of summarize it and particularly focus on where it fits in from a practical clinical perspective, sort of outside a trial?
Right. So if you think back, this is something that shouldn't have surprised us. If you think of the embryology, of course, you remember your embryology.
Right.
We all do. I think I missed that class in medical school.
But I missed a lot of classes in medical school.
Yeah. You and me both. The right side of the colon comes from the midgut, and the left side comes from the hindgut, and they merge during embryogenesis. And the transverse colon is somewhere is right and somewhere is left of origin. So it shouldn't surprise us that there'd be a biology that's different right versus left. For many years, people had observed that patients with right-sided primaries don't do as well, but the assumption was always, well, the disease presents later in its course. The stool is liquid on the right side, the colon is large, and it's much less likely that you'll get obstructive symptoms. And so people said, well, you just have more disease because there's a time lag, and that could have been. I had no clue that this was as meaningful a difference as it turns out to be. I was motivated to look, one, because we started realizing there were genetic molecular features that were more so on the right than the left, let's say BRAF mutations, more commonly on right-sided. So it led some of us to think, geez, maybe there's a difference. And then there's an old study published in 2001 of a five different regimens of 5-FU that in fact showed a five-month delta in survival left primaries better than right. That's what motivated me to go in and look at every chart and figure out sidedness in retrospect because we hadn't collected the data prospectively. And I was flabbergasted that there was a 13 or 14-month difference in all the patients left versus right. And then as we started drilling down, it's very clear that patients with right-sided cancers, independent of their RAS status, get almost no benefit, if any at all, from the EGFR antibodies. So the practical impact is, while I think it's appropriate to do molecular analyses on our patients to really identify where they might head initially or certainly beyond first line, I think it's clear that patients with right-sided primaries, you don't need a RAS mutated or not to know that you shouldn't use EGFR antibodies on first line. Whether you can use EGFR antibodies subsequently in patients with right-sided tumors is not so clear. Remember, all the studies that have really looked at this except one were really restricted to first line. And now how somebody could get benefit subsequent line but not first line, I'm not quite sure biologically, but we don't know that these patients stand to get no benefit from EGFR antibodies. Our study clearly showed that the group that did the worst by far were the group that had right-sided primaries who got cetuximab in our study.
When you talk about a 13 or 14-month difference, specifically in what?
So in overall survival. So in our study, in the whole group, if you look at all the KRAS, just the fundamental first analysis, which was just published in JAMA a few months ago, the KRAS wild-type group was about a 32 versus 19-month survival left versus right, which is really stunning. I mean, that's a big difference. And you'd think, like, what were we thinking that we didn't realize this? And then what we further did at ASCO this year, Federico Innocenti and Heinz-Joseph Lenz presented our data on looking at all the molecular features of the cancers. And in fact, we found that sidedness is still prognostic even when you incorporate all the other molecular information. BRAF, which, of course, patients with BRAF mutations have a poor prognosis. Those tend to be right-sided. MSI-high patients tend to be right-sided. Those patients do better without metastatic disease, but don't do so well with metastatic disease. Even when you add all of these factors in, it turns out sidedness remain prognostic. I think that just means we haven't figured out yet what the biology is. It's not like right versus left. There's got to be some biological explanation. We haven't gotten it yet, though.
Now, I assume that the explanation is not related to the issue of EGFR antibodies.
Correct. I think it's not. My bet is it's got something to do with the stem cells, which would be the tissues of origin, or something like that. The other black hole, the black box that we have no idea really where it's contributing, but I bet it is the biome. And clearly there's some evidence that the bacteria from the left colon to the right colon is different. And in particular, I mean, it's astonishing if you really dig into this literature, we see that you can find bacterial DNA in mets in the patients with liver mets. I mean, how bizarre is that? So I can't explain it, but that's probably a factor.
So from a practical point of view, other than, you know, just the prognostic implications of this and also EGFR antibodies, which at least in the United States, I think are not very commonly used first line anyhow, what is the practical implication? Do you think that in a patient with a right-sided lesion, maybe you think about triplet therapy, for example, more often, even without BRAF?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, yes, probably so. That's how we treat most of our patients these days. When you get the new patient, it may be 2-3 weeks before you'll get the molecular analysis. So even if you're a right-sided patient, you don't need to know their RAS status, unless if they're RAS mutant, then they don't have a BRAF mutation. The two of those don't go together. If they're RAS wild type, you'd like to know BRAF and be poised to move them on to something else, because those patients may do reasonably well first line, but really don't do well down the road. And as you know from the TRIBE study from Italy, clearly patients with the triplet FOLFOXIRI do better with BRAF mutations than if you treat them with the doublets. So as a default, if you don't know the BRAF status in patients, especially if they have a lot of disease, we tend to err on the side of triplet therapy up front, and then usually we drop the oxali in a month or two if they're doing well.
You mentioned the biome, and you had some fascinating slides in a slide deck that you sent to us that I was curious about. Can you talk a little bit more about what we've learned about that? You also talk about this Fusobacterium nucleatum. I'm not sure I pronounced it correctly. Maybe just talk a little bit more about the biology of what we know about this.
Yeah, well, I can take 2 seconds, and that's about what I understand of it. You just summarized it all, right? So the Harvard folks have done the best work on it, I think. We have got 3 different scientists working on the biome here at UCSF. It's very clear that the microbiome has interactions with the immunologic system, for sure, and or with drug metabolism, metabolism of toxins. For instance, could it be that we think that capecitabine may be metabolized in some people by the microbiome partially, so that it may be activated in the gut before it's even absorbed as a prodrug? So could that account for changes in toxicity, et cetera? In terms of the way the diseases evolve, the data from the Farber suggests that patients with Fusobacterium nucleatum, which tends to be dominant more on the right side than the left side of the colon, those patients tend to have higher risk of cancer and don't do so well. Again, proving that it's cause and effect is difficult. I mean, when you get into the nitty-gritty here, you realize it's really even hard to sample the biome without thinking that you might change it. Right? Because you put a swab in, you know, does that change the environment? Or you have a patient who, of course, has had a bowel prep. Well, tell me about the biome in that patient. I mean, it's ridiculously complicated. And, you know, it's evolving. The people at Hopkins think, the pathologists at Hopkins think there's like a biofilm. So some people have sort of bacteria embedded in the crypts in the bowel, and that could be related to the risk of cancer because it may disturb the immune cell's function. It's immensely complex, and again, we're not even close to having a handle on it, but it's some of the most fascinating research there is, I think.
Speaking of Hopkins, I was going to ask you in terms of, I think you alluded to the possibility that somehow the biome is related to the immune system, checkpoint inhibitors, et cetera. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so we know that there's an interaction. We don't know consistently over what the makeup of the biome is to optimize the outcome, but it's thought that that probably explains why not everybody with MSI high colon cancer benefits from the checkpoint inhibitors, but more importantly, why even when patients benefit, many will develop resistance. So the assumption is that the biome has something to do with resistance, somehow in the trafficking of lymphocytes in the crypt. You know, again, we're starting to wave our hands when we start talking about these details. But immense opportunity if we could figure this out. As I said, we've got a number of groups around the country have huge efforts in the microbiome. It's not as if we haven't known about this for a long time, but it's just now dawning on everybody that it really is important.
You mentioned the issue of BRAF, and maybe you can provide an update on where we are with patients with BRAF mutations and how in your own practice outside a trial setting, you factor this into your clinical decisions.
Yeah, so we know that Scott Kopetz presented the SWOG randomized phase 2 study at ASCO this year looking at the use of a BRAF inhibitor in combination with chemotherapy or with an EGFR antibody, and clearly showed, in this case with a irinotecan and or an EGFR antibody, or actually in his case it was a MEK inhibitor. I mean, clearly you see that combinations with BRAF inhibitors improve at least disease-free survival or progression-free survival, I should say, because these are metastatic patients. It's a different question what the survival impact is. We don't know that there's a survival impact yet. It's not as simple as in melanoma where patients can respond to monotherapy BRAF inhibitors, even though it's the same mutation, the V600E mutation. I should say the BRAF, there are many, many mutations. The one that we're talking about here is the V600E mutation. Now, the problem here is if you treat these patients, let's say with FOLFOXIRI up front, even if you get a good response, what do you do next? And these folks can go down really rapidly. The disease can turn on a dime. So it's a real struggle because for the data that supports either dabrafenib or vemurafenib in combinations, various combinations, neither of those are before the FDA, nor are the studies robust enough to go to the FDA. There are a few studies out there right now that are ongoing that may serve to go to the FDA, but they're not even close to done. I think Array has a RAF inhibitor that they're looking at. So it's really a predicament. You can look at the molecular features of a patient's cancer and say, gee, you've got a BRAF mutation, that's bad, and then what do you do about it? Unless you can get them on a study, and that study may very well randomize patients so they don't receive the RAF inhibitor. And this is really an ethical, moral problem for many of us. So part of the question is, can we somehow shake loose BRAF inhibitors so we can put them into patients? It's no panacea, but at least some patients have a much better outcome.
So then, assuming you can access BRAF inhibitor or maybe in combination with other targeted therapies, do you offer any type of targeted therapy to patients outside a trial who have BRAF mutations?
Well, guilty as charged. So yeah, you know, in general, that's not something I would suggest, except that with BRAF mutant patients, I think we're stuck. So we have petitioned the sponsors, pharmaceutical companies, to get the RAF inhibitors. Insurers on occasion have paid for it, and we have treated some patients off study. Much preferable would be to either get these approved or to get insurers to pay for it. It's a need population. It's not a huge percentage of patients. It's only about 3 or 4% of patients with metastatic colon cancer.
Yeah, but I mean, 3 to 4% of colon cancer
big
is a
number.
Lot of people.
Absolutely right. Big number.
You know, lung cancer, they treat subsets that are 1%, and, you know.
Totally agree.
And actually, it's interesting mentioning lung cancer. We watched the BRAF story evolve there. Initially, it wasn't clear which way it was going to go, more like colon or more like melanoma. Now, I mean, there's approved combination, BRAF-MEK, and when you ask investigators, they're using it first line.
Yeah.
So that's kind of following the melanoma pattern.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. I think that's one place where I could see moving these agents up front, especially patients with such a bad disease. You wonder if the RAF inhibitors are only modestly effective because patients have already had enough mutational events and other problems with their cancer that you've already induced resistance. I mean, what we're doing and some groups are doing really aggressively is doing serial biopsies of patients with colon cancer, because we have to understand why and how patients develop resistance if we're ultimately going to make a big difference, I think. So BRAF, it's really great that we've identified it. Now, if only we can really be aggressive in targeting it and get things on the market that can help us do that.
And just to be clear, when you talk about trying to access these types of agents, you're talking about single agent monotherapy with a BRAF inhibitor?
No. So for colon cancer, the monotherapy, at least dabrafenib and vemurafenib, have essentially no activity as monotherapies. So at our place, we work with combinations looking with EGFR antibodies and irinotecan, other combinations with MEK inhibitor, which is commercially available. So we mix and match. I mean, it's not scientific, but essentially we just feel compelled to at least give patients a chance at a good response or at least controlling their disease reasonably well if they have a BRAF mutation.
So speaking of targeted therapy of colon cancer, as long as we brought BRAF up, why don't we touch a little bit on HER2? It's kind of been an interesting evolution over the last few years. And I also want to ask you about your paper in Journal National Comprehensive Cancer, JNCCN, looking at a patient who got T-DM1. Really interesting. Can you kind of provide an overview of where we are with HER2 amplified and mutant, for that matter, colorectal cancer?
Yeah, so it's also a small subset, 3 or 4%. And I think it probably took us a while to figure out that these folks could benefit. I remember there was a study maybe a decade ago when trastuzumab was first approved, maybe 20 years ago, and we saw really no activity in relatively unselected patients with colon cancer. So it matters. Sidedness probably matters. Gender may matter. There are a lot of variables with HER2, ERBB2, and the way to affect the receptors. What we did on the patient, and we see probably 3 or 4% of patients who are either HER2 amplified or HER2 mutant when we do our big assay. And this is one of the few advantages of centers that have very large, comprehensive next-gen sequencing assays. So we have what's called the UC500. So we get genes you don't need to know about, you would assume. But surprisingly often, we were seeing HER2 amplification or HER2 mutations. And in particular, we had a patient who is actually a physician scientist from Germany, whose insurance in Germany was perfectly willing to give us whatever he wanted. So when he came, he had rapidly progressive cancer, just really primarily refractory disease, which you almost never see. And we jumped in with T-DM1, and he had about a 7 or 8 month minor response and then stable disease, which at least steadied things a little bit so he could sort of deal with what was going on. Really pretty striking. And he was HER2 amplified. Interestingly, we re-biopsied him when he progressed and he had lost the HER2 amplification. Whether it was a sampling difference or actually the disease had developed resistance or morphed away from the HER2 amplification, we don't know. But it's a nice opportunity, really, because we have a number of drugs available for it. Not common, but there are studies now looking at bringing this into early use in the subset of patients with HER2 amplified or mutated colon cancer. Again, 3 or 4% of patients.
Just out of curiosity, I guess T-DM1 usually is well tolerated, no alopecia, at least we know from breast cancer, sometimes hepatic problems, thrombocytopenia. How'd this man do?
He did incredibly well. We actually, what the heck, we combined pertuzumab with T-DM1.
Wow.
And he did really almost remarkably well. As you know, we wrote up the case in JNCCN, which looks for sort of the exceptional responders kinds of stuff. This is not average, I'm sure, but he did really remarkably well given the tempo and the course of his disease, although not for as long as we would have liked. He tolerated it very well.
What do you think would be reasonable, if anything, to consider outside a trial setting with HER2 amplified colon cancer? There was a trial, I think it was looking at trastuzumab and lapatinib, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Right. The so-called, I think, Hercules trial.
Is that a strategy you would use outside a trial?
I think it's not crazy. I don't think lapatinib's a very good inhibitor. It's hard to get the dose in that's enough to, you know, lead to suppression. And there are a few studies looking at HER2 combinations going on. Again, this is another one of those things that it'd be interesting to see if any company is going to go forward with a big enough study to get it approved. I mean, there's very little reason for companies to go through the millions of dollars and the man hours necessary to get a drug approved for another indication when they've already got a bunch of indications already settled. So this may be another example where we'll have to somehow work around whether FDA approval exists or not. But I think in HER2, we need a little more data to make us confident. That's another example where moving it up front may be of benefit. And I suppose in the adjuvant setting, it might be of benefit in patients who are HER2 positive. I actually don't know the likelihood. I don't know how many patients who present with less than stage 4 disease are HER2 amplified or mutated. Somebody knows that probably, but I don't.
Do you think that T-DM1 would be a reasonable non-protocol option for a patient? I mean, they've got your paper here.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, that's obviously why we did it. And it's all things wrapped up in one. It's an antibody conjugate, really pretty well tolerated, at least in our patients. So, yeah, I think these are interesting questions. The problem for all of these questions is when you've got a couple percentage of patients and they're getting many lines of therapy, and some of these patients you're not. It's one thing to do a study in breast cancer with HER2 at targeting because everybody knows to get HER2 analysis. The average bear with colon cancer in the community may get, we're lucky these days, hopefully they'll get at least all RAS and MSI status and BRAF, but they're not going to get HER2. And so doing this, really moving it in force into patients earlier will require a lot more molecular testing than goes on right now.
You mentioned HER2 mutations, and we've heard a lot about that, again, in lung cancer, not so much in breast cancer. And there they talk about using TKIs. Now you have neratinib approved as post-adjuvant therapy in breast cancer, but I've heard people talk about it with relation to HER2 mutations. What do you do if you find somebody who has a HER2 mutation?
You know, we've not had the same success. We've had a modest success in the amplified patients. We do the same thing. We've tried a variety of the things you've talked about. In general, the TKIs, the EGFR TKIs, are very poorly tolerated in patients with colon cancer, at least. They have terrible bowel problems for the most part. I don't know if it's got to do with distribution of the receptors or whatever. But we've not had nearly the success with mutated patients as we have with amplified patients.
So I want to ask you also about work that you've been involved with. A lot of it came out of Dana-Farber also, looking at the issue of physical activity and nutrition and colon cancer in terms of progression, disease-free survival, for example. Can you talk about globally what you've learned from this research?
Well, this is, I think, the brilliance of the group, the Dana-Farber, who about 20 years ago really pushed and pushed and forced the cooperative groups to include very detailed questionnaires in a study called 89803, which was the adjuvant colon study that looked at irinotecan. In the U.S., Len Saltz led that study, and the study was absolutely negative. There's no difference whatsoever in outcome across the irinotecan versus 5-FU alone arms. In fact, there was much more toxicity with the irinotecan. But in that study, they really had very detailed information on diet, exercise, lifestyle habits otherwise, you know, how much TV you watch. You can't believe the wealth of data. And analysis after analysis has shown that with that data set, it's clear and hard to explain exactly why this would be. In fact, these patients with stage 3 colon cancer, they were likelier to not recur if they had a variety of good habits and more likely to recur if they had bad habits. Now, you could say, well, that's because maybe these were patients who were couch potatoes before they got their colon cancer, and that's why they did so badly. It doesn't seem to be related to what their status was when they got the diagnosis. Really pretty remarkable. I think most of us really have always been troubled by the idea that diet or lifestyle could have that much impact on outcomes in cancer, and I think this data is pretty compelling. In fact, one of the young women in my group here, Erin Van Blarigan, worked with the data set from 89803 and with folks at Farber who are really quite expert in this kind of molecular epi, Jeff Meyerhart, Charlie Fuchs. And she actually had one of the lead papers at ASCO this year where they did an analysis in the same population and looked at what the American Cancer Society would call healthy living, which is, let's say, a couple of drinks a day for a male, one drink a day for a female, no cigarettes, a non-Western diet, so no In-N-Out burger kind of thing, maybe an aspirin a day, good exercise, don't sit and watch TV. You know, all these factors that people say this is a good lifestyle and this isn't. And the patients who met the ACS criteria for good lifestyle had a far superior survival in this stage 3 study than patients who didn't. Really pretty striking. Again, how do you implement that? I don't know. And there must be some molecular predisposition that we don't understand, but I think very interesting data. And just as I believe in vitamin D, I mean, we tried to do vitamin D as part of an adjuvant study in 80702. This was a dozen years ago, and the NCI and others rejected it. And now Kimmy Ng has data just with vitamin D in patients with stage 4 colon cancer getting chemotherapy with FOLFOX, with or without vitamin D. Patients who get vitamin D do better, at least in progression-free survival. So I think a lot of our assumptions that diet and all can't have that much of an effect, I think we're just wrong. But it's not so easy to separate out the factors to understand what the main factor is.
For practical purposes, what do you do in terms of vitamin D, both in the adjuvant and metastatic setting?
Well, so I'm a little bit loony about that. We check everybody's vitamin D and we replete vitamin D. I just fundamentally believe it. It's easy enough to do, and especially in this era where everybody's afraid of skin cancer and, you know, puts on lots of sunblock, those are people who tend to be vitamin D insufficient. I mean, maybe what we consider a normal vitamin D may not be correct, the value at least. 80% of people are said to be vitamin D insufficient. And so I routinely replace vitamin D and, you know, really try to get it up to normal. And there's talk of a randomized study that would do that. I mean, the challenge, of course, is that once people hear about vitamin D, like, why wouldn't they take vitamin D? It's not like taking chemotherapy. So practically speaking, we give major recommendations about, we have a huge effort in exercise in our patients with both early stage and advanced cancer, as well as in nutritional things and supplements like vitamin D.
And you tell your patients, I'd like you to try to do this because it maybe will help in terms of the disease.
Right. I mean, I think patients really are empowered. I think it's really important for patients to at least have some control over what they're doing. And so I think being able to make decisions about vitamins or other supplements, I think it's really valuable. And what do you know? It may actually be helpful.
You mentioned, you know, some of the broad issues with a, quote, healthy diet. What level of exercise? I know the data suggests it's not necessary to be that intense or for that much. What do you actually tell your patients?
I can't remember the exact criteria. In the paper of that, the group that looked at the exercise in 89803, I think it was the equivalent of mowing a lawn, a big lawn once a week, or let's say, you know, walking 2 miles at a leisurely pace during a week. So I just say, with the contrary, the other side of the coin is if you sit and watch TV all the time, you don't do so well. So our advice is to just take 3 walks a week. Let's say, you know, you might want to walk at a mall or at a park where you can sit down periodically, that kind of thing. And I think it's got to do with the number of calories you burn, and people think it may have to do with revving up insulin or using insulin. I mean, the mechanisms are curious, but we do recommend exercise. In fact, the same woman who presented the data at ASCO, Erin Van Blarigan, we have a big number of studies that are looking at different ways of reminding patients to exercise. They have Fitbits, they get text messages, a variety of social media to encourage them. You know, Big Brother's watching you, you're sitting around, you should be exercising. So we really encourage our patients to do that. And then when they come to our center, they have to park so far from the place that they get some exercise in that regard too. Just kidding.
Well, yeah, maybe not. But just out of curiosity, is it your observation or belief that exercise also helps with anxiety?
I really believe strongly that giving patients elements that they can control is so important, because much of, I believe, a lot of the anxiety of cancer patients, other than the horror, the uncertainty, is that so much is out of their control. So I really believe strongly in seeing what patients can have control over and letting them do that. I think it's a very valuable thing.
So let's spend the rest of the time talking about your cases, beginning with your 46-year-old man.
So the first case, this is a 46-year-old fellow who had a cecal primary and a lot of nodal disease in the retroperitoneum and supraclavicular area. That's kind of unusual to have no dominant disease in colon cancer. But he had no apparent visceral metastases. So the issue, of course, is in these patients, do you take the primary route? In somebody who's got this kind of bulky disease, we typically wouldn't. He was started in the community on FOLFOX-BEV, which is what 75% of the oncologists use for frontline colon cancer. He came to see us, and this is an example we talked earlier. This is a right-sided cancer, sort of weird behavior. This is a patient I recommended that they go to FOLFOX-ERI-BEV, which they did, and we got our molecular test done. And it turns out that this was a patient who had MLH1 deficiency, which is to say he was MSI high. Otherwise, everything was wild type. So this was a difficult case because here you've got a patient, you're given aggressive chemotherapy, and you know you might jump in with a checkpoint inhibitor at some point. In fact, now there are checkpoint inhibitors that will be in frontline studies. So the challenge in this patient was, how long do you treat with the current chemotherapy and when do you jump in with the checkpoint inhibitor? And our approach in a patient like this is to get as much mileage out of standard chemotherapy as we can. Mind you, not everybody responds to the checkpoint inhibitors, even if they're MSI high. So I think this is one of the reasons you want to look, get early information on the molecular features of the cancer. And again, a right-sided cancer is likelier to be MSI high and BRAF mutant as well. And MSI high and BRAF mutations overlap about 25 or 30%. And those are patients who the BRAF may be sort of an aberration. So this is an example of the patient we would continue aggressive therapy and then take the first opportunity to use the checkpoint inhibitor. And as you know, this is sort of unprecedented. I believe MSI high patients are the only circumstance where drugs are approved based on molecular features and not and agnostic to the site of origin of the cancer. So this is why it's really important in right-sided patients, especially with bad acting disease, to really figure out what the molecular features are.
So just out of curiosity, again, outside a trial setting, or maybe you can tell me what kind of trial, if you had seen this patient up front and known he was MSI high from the beginning, what would you have done treatment-wise, or would there be a trial you would have put him in?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. At this moment, there's not a trial available yet. They're sort of working their way through the regulatory situation. We don't have one, at least. I think there may be one industry study. It's a tough call. We give patients the option. Most patients, interestingly enough, opt for chemotherapy. We've had half a dozen patients like this. Most of them opt for chemotherapy, and then we may jump in later on, especially with somebody with a big, bulky disease. You worry that if you don't get on top of it, you may lose a patient. But I could see a time not too far away where we might start with a checkpoint inhibitor, and if it doesn't work, then go to chemotherapy. You know, one of the dilemmas with immunotherapies is it's hard to know if it's working or not. And although it's more so with the anti-CTLA-4 and other immune modulators, you worry about sort of pseudo-progression or delayed response. And in a patient with bulky disease, you worry whether you have the luxury of waiting 3-4 months to see if the treatment works. So we tend to still lean with chemotherapy. Again, the studies now are starting to combine chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors. And there's no reason we shouldn't do that. I think companies, sponsors were afraid, well, chemotherapy may interfere with the immune system. If anything, I think chemotherapy could augment the effects of the checkpoint inhibitors. And so in combination may ultimately be where we get to, but that's going to take a while.
And of course, much to a lot of people's surprise, actually the combination of chemotherapy and a checkpoint inhibitor, pembrolizumab, was actually approved in lung cancer, non-squamous disease.
Correct.
And a lot of people are using it. There's a lot of debate and controversy about it. This man actually, because he'd already gotten started on treatment, you switched him to FOLFOXIRI Bev, I guess because of the location of the primary being right-sided. But even though he's 46 years old, it looks like he had some problems with that.
Yeah, so the FOLFOXIRI Bev is not easy. And this patient got neutropenic fever and I think had a 4 or 5 day hospitalization. Again, he was cared for in the community. So as it was reported, ultimately he came back and we put him on pembrolizumab just at the time because he also was losing weight. He didn't look so good. He'd responded actually, but the chemotherapy had beaten him up. And he's actually done remarkably well on the pembro. I mean, he had a good response and it's augmented the response so far. We're not far enough into it to know how he's going to do long term, but he's done very, very well.
What are the global figures that you have in your own head about response rate in these patients and particularly the issue of prolonged disease control, you know, more than, let's say, a couple of years?
Yeah, so there's not much data on colon cancer yet. I mean, you hear about the melanoma population with a, I don't know, I hear 10% long durable response, durable remissions. I actually don't know in colon cancer yet what the numbers are going to be. In our hands, we've seen across the board, though, most patients in our studies where we have 32 studies, I think, in our GI group here at UCSF, and 20 of them have different immunotherapies. And by and large, the responders are really robust responders and very durable. But I'd say maybe 30, and these are patients selected for features that you would expect them to benefit, let's say MSI high in particular. Probably 1 in 3 are getting really good responses, but they are very often very robust and durable. And again, we have some exceptional responders, you know, a young fellow with hepatocellular carcinoma who's almost 3 years out with bulky metastatic disease, with hepatocellular on a checkpoint inhibitor who's a complete remission sustained 3 years later off treatment. This is unprecedented in my experience to see people who literally almost rise from the ashes with these treatments. It's phenomenal the benefit some people get.
I was doing a few interviews a couple weeks ago, 3 different cancers. I don't remember. I think it was lung, head, neck, and maybe a heme. And each one of those interviews had a patient who was about to go into hospice, who got a checkpoint inhibitor and, you know, whatever. Amazing story.
I mean, you know, you've done this long. You don't see that. It's almost right to the point, like, how do you not offer patients this treatment? It's astonishing that you can have such an amazing impact so quickly in patients who are otherwise just beyond hope.
Although the big difference, for example, in something like lung is you have a lot higher frequency response in MSI
Correct.
High. What's your vision of the pathophysiology of why you see this in these tumors? What are the PD-L1 levels? What's your concept?
You know, I don't think we understand. The slide that every one of us has suggests that the number of mutations is related to the likelihood of the checkpoint inhibitors working. The concept is that the more mutations, the more foreign proteins, and the better chance the immune system has of identifying one to attack. It's not that simple. Obviously, in hepatocellular carcinoma, for example, the responses doesn't matter if they're viral mediated or not. These are not highly mutated cancers. So it's not as simple as that, and nor is it as simple, I don't think, as PD-1 or PD-L1 levels, although that may also matter. I think at the end of the day, a lot of it has to do with the tissue of origin and the trafficking of lymphocytes into the tissues, whatever motivates the lymphocytes to be there or not. And again, this is a black box. And I believe the biome may have a lot to do with this, actually. So I at least am miles away from understanding it. Now, at UCSF, in our cancer center, one of the things that we're building is a program to study the toxicities of the checkpoint inhibitors in these immune therapies, because the other problem is they're not a free lunch. While they can be dramatically effective, they're like an internist nightmare. You know, we've seen everything from myasthenia gravis to thyroid storm to severe pulmonary toxicity. So these drugs are not without problems, but really, in some cases, dramatically effective.
It's interesting. What are you looking at in terms of toxicity? And do you have any experience? Are you gathering any data? I don't know how often it happens in patients with prior autoimmune conditions, Crohn's disease, et cetera.
Yeah, a great question. You know, so for years, we were afraid to look at those patients. In fact, it's a mixed bag. Some patients have gone on these treatments with, let's say, autoimmune Crohn's in particular and had no problems, and others have had horrific exacerbations of their autoimmune diseases. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. Clearly, we don't understand a lot of the moving parts. I do think that we have certainly been loath to use these agents in these patients, but we've seen a few responses to the point that we're now willing to do so. You know, I've had a patient go into renal failure. I mean, almost every organ has and will be affected by these treatments.
I was going to ask you one final question. What do you see in terms of the phenotype of MSI-high disease? I've heard people say that pathologists maybe suspect it under the microscope. This patient had this weird presentation with all these lymph nodes. What's the typical phenotypes that you see?
Right. So the main phenotype that we see that should spring to mind is right-sided, but also mucinous, mucin-containing tumors. And if you look at a scan, CT scan, it's pretty obvious who has a mucinous colon cancer and who doesn't. The mucinous tumors just look like sort of gook. I mean, these are heterogeneous, sort of streaky tumors that look like they have internal areas of necrosis. And that's what brings to mind the MSI-high patient. The other thing I should comment on is the MSI-high and BRAF mutant patients tend not to have measurable disease, or often don't. In fact, our group had a paper, Chloe Atreya had a paper a few months ago with that characterization. And one of the things that we probably will realize is that most of the studies in advanced colon cancer have not included many of these patients because most studies required measurable disease. In our study, 80405, we did not require measurable disease. We had about 40 patients without measurable disease. Most of them were either BRAF mutant or MSI high. So these are classically, let's say, ascites, malignant ascites, or peritoneal implants, or you know, something like that, where you knew they had cancer, but you couldn't quantify it.
So let's move on and talk about your 65-year-old man.
Right, so this is a fellow who presented with stage 4 disease and had a resection of his primary, who initially responded to chemotherapy and then ultimately went to a liver metastatectomy and more chemotherapy. So he did not have FOLFOX initially. He went only about 6 months and then recurred and went back on FOLFOX Bev and ultimately went on sort of maintenance capecitabine Bev, which we're doing more and more. One of the things that I'm always cognizant of is when you start with bevacizumab, we tend to be hesitant to stop it because of the TML data, the idea that patients may progress more rapidly after you stop the Bev. This patient, he had had such a great response to irinotecan initially. When he progressed, we put him on a study which had one of these new irinotecan knockoffs, a pegylated irinotecan and an EGFR inhibitor, which it was unclear if he got any benefit. He opted out after 2 months. And at that point, we offered him other trials, but he sort of went on the conventional route and went to regorafenib and then ultimately TAS-102. I mean, as I've described many of our patients here at UCSF, regorafenib and TAS-102 certainly in some patients can have a positive impact, but we don't have any hesitation about putting patients on a study rather than using either one of those two drugs because we don't think the upside is that significant. This patient got tired and didn't want to go on more studies, and he liked the idea of pills, and so we did that. And I would say that, you know, they're not non-toxic. With regorafenib, we tend to start at a low dose and work our way up, and that may be a mistake. Maybe we're underdosing patients. TAS-102, we were looking at in a variety of combinations, especially with radioembolization, for example. But these are treatments we do really for patients who need to know they're being treated. And It's always a challenge when you don't expect drugs to give you a response. So how do you know if they're benefiting or not? And so this is always a struggle for me and for many of our group and lots of people everywhere in terms of, are you making a patient sick or not? Are you impacting the disease? Tough drugs to know how to use. Be interesting to see if TAS, for example, could be moved up into earlier line because it does seem to be different than 5-FU.
You mentioned dosing of Rivaroxaban. What dose did you use in him and how did he do?
So this is a fellow, routinely we start at 80 and we worked him up to 160. So what I start is at really half dose pretty much. And most people start around 120, I think, these days. I started at 80, he was doing well and we ramped it up. With the TKIs like this, as we learned, let's say with imatinib and GI stromal tumor, you can start low and work up. If you have a lot of toxicity at the start with a higher dose, sometimes it's hard to go down from there and not induce more toxicity. Again, I worry that I'm not sure that any of us, or certainly I'm not sure that we or I am using regorafenib or TAS in the right way because we tend to reserve it for patients at the end of the road and we may be waiting too long or not dosing it aggressively enough. This is a problem. But I do think regorafenib in particular is quite toxic at 160. And so they've explored lower doses and probably it's fine to use lower doses, but the label still calls for 160 a day.
How long was he on treatment? And from your point of view, do you think he benefited?
Well, I thought he did. You know, I remember, I think he was on for about 4 or 5 months and he got really tired. And you never know if he was just depressed and tired or if the drug induced it. So 4 or 5 months, I considered that a win because his disease was progressing when he went on it. So I think probably we get more sort of stasis of disease with these drugs than we get responses. And, you know, but patients, as they're down the road, fatigue and other things start to interfere. And it's hard to know if it's disease progression or if it's just the wear and tear. I mean, we know that drugs, let's say like regorafenib or sorafenib, certainly sorafenib, which has been used a lot in, let's say, kidney cancer patients, we know that there's a muscle wasting that happens over months and months of use. And so I don't doubt that these drugs could add to the wear and tear and sort of make patients a little more fatigued before their time.
What do you see in terms of tolerability issues with regorafenib? Do you see hypertension, for example?
It's interesting. So the answer is usually not, but that's probably because these are patients, almost all of whom have had bevacizumab and didn't have problems with bevacizumab hypertension. The few patients I've had who have, let's say, severe grade 3 or greater hypertension on Bev, I tend not to use regorafenib because it's a class effect. So these patients have sort of proved to us that they're not going to get in trouble. And not to mention that most patients at the end of the road, as they are getting more progressive cancer, very few patients have hypertension as a major problem because I think their vascular tone, all these other factors have come into play. Hypertension is not usually something we face at third or fourth line.
So one of the things that I've heard described, and I'm curious if you've ever observed, and I think not just with TKIs like regorafenib, but maybe even with bevacizumab, is a phenomenon where you see cavitation in the tumor. I've heard it's kind of like part of a response. Have you ever observed that?
Yeah, we see that. Not unusual. Certainly with Bev, we see that. And I've seen it with regorafenib, but you see it even with a number of other therapies. I think it's a bit exaggerated, the risk. Clearly, the original bevacizumab data in squamous cell cancer of the lung, that delayed its approval because of the fact that patients were at risk for bronchial bleeds or lung bleeds with that sort of necrosis from within. In colon cancer, in general, we see that, and I don't usually worry about it. I take that as a general positive. I think maybe once, I've seen a couple of these get infected, super infected, but I've never really had a patient get a severe bleed with colon cancer who got Bev or regorafenib, or even for ramucirumab, which is the same mechanism.
So this patient got TAS-102 after getting regorafenib. First of all, how often are you able to get both agents into people, and how do you decide which one goes first?
Yeah, so here at UC, where we take care of a lot of complex patients, usually if these patients get to third or fourth line, they're usually back in their community, because a lot of our patients come from a distance, and to give them regorafenib or TAS-102, we generally discourage them from schlepping into San Francisco. So we don't get a lot of patients like this. It's a difference which one we use. In a patient who I think has gotten a benefit from Bev in combination, I tend to lean towards regorafenib because I do think that TAS-102 is just another fluoropyrimidine, and at least we tend to see a lot of marrow toxicity. But again, I would emphasize that our patients are generally very heavily treated. We've been very aggressive. in a lot of these patients with liver resections and all, and I'm not sure that, you know, we're using TAS or regorafenib correctly and or to the right degree. And I personally tend to be very averse to making patients sick. So patients are third or fourth line, and they're fatigued or they're having neutropenia, they're admitted to the hospital with febrile neutropenia, I'm hard-pressed to keep treating them because I really don't think I'm helping them that much.
Any comments on the issue of neutropenia with TAS 102 and also this suggestion that maybe patients do better if they get neutropenia?
Yeah, so that's true. It's an interesting observation. We see it pretty often, again, because I'm pretty aggressive with dosing TAS 102. In particular, we have a study, for example, with radioembolization and TAS 102, where neutropenia and thrombocytopenia are pretty common, and we see good responses. So I do think it's a radiosensitizer, at least with radioembolization as we're doing it. And, you know, in that setting, I'm willing to use growth factors, and certainly it will support it. I just have trouble using drugs third or fourth line with clearly marginal advantage for most patients and putting them in the hospital with fever or using growth factors. But I think, again, some people can get months and months out of these treatments, so it's not something you should just disdain. It's just the patients who don't get benefit, you tend to abandon it early.
So one other thing about this case that I thought was fascinating, I couldn't wait to ask you about, is his current situation.
Yeah. He's still alive. He's probably 6 months down. After all this stuff, he's alive. I think he's taking Chinese herbs and mushrooms, and he's living large. He's playing golf, and his fatigue is gone. So in retrospect, certainly it seemed to have been chemotherapy-induced. So that's the other amazing thing. Sometimes we take credit. We think we're making a big difference in patients with our interventions, and sometimes if you leave them be, they'll do fine. So he checked in just a few weeks ago just to find out if we had anything new going on.
Yeah, I was really struck by that, and I totally agree with what you're saying. I think it was really interesting. At what point would you send him to hospice?
So in California, we have an end-of-life act, and this is something he's opted for. So the end-of-life act, basically, when we believe the patient has less than 6 months to live, there's a law that has the capacity to prescribe them a cocktail that they can self-administer. I actually don't write the prescriptions. That's been my own philosophy. He did opt for the end-of-life act. He has a prescription, and he's still alive 6 months later. So it's sort of the best of both worlds. This person has the autonomy and the ability when it's all said and done, but he's living life well and enjoying it. And so it's a reminder that, you know, patients, giving them some time on their own is good, and some patients can get a whole lot of it. So he is a super appreciative guy because we gave him permission to leave and go back home, and he did, and he's doing very well.
That's really fascinating. I was interviewing, I don't know if you know, Ross Kamage from Colorado, and they have a similar law. He was telling me about a patient he had. He was very uncomfortable, told me the same thing about he didn't want to write the prescription, but he was okay, I guess, doing the other part of it. And the interesting thing was he checked back with the patient, I guess, a month or so later, the family, expecting to get the family, and the patient was there. And the patient never used a prescription, and the patient decided, I just wanted to know it was there.
Yeah, no, and I think that's perfectly reasonable. The problem here in California is the cocktails are, I think, very difficult, cumbersome. There's a heavy dose of secanol in the cocktails.
Right, and he was telling me the same thing. There's like 100 capsules and all this stuff.
Right, so here we can put it all in a solution. The problem is patients have to drink it within 10 minutes to have the full effect.
Right.
And so they may fall asleep before they get, I mean, it's not ideal.
Crazy.
It's one of those laws that I think perfectly well-intentioned, but implementing it is not always so straightforward.
Have you had any patients who actually did that?
I have not. No, we've had some patients in our group have opted to do that. I have not had any do that.
I just, when I heard that story originally from Ross and now from you, I was thinking, you know, maybe it's just like a safety thing for the patient to know they have it, but that if they're well managed, maybe they never will have to use it.
Well, we did some research a year ago. The law was just started in California, implemented in June of a year ago. And in Oregon, where they've had the capacity, patients have had the flexibility of doing this for a long time, very few people have opted in. And I believe in California, the number of patients who've opted for the cocktail is in the hundreds.
Hmm.
I mean, California is a big state. I have no idea if those people also took their lives or used the prescription. I just know that I think that's the number of people who got the prescription.
So let's finish out with your 66-year-old man.
Okay, this is a patient who had a solitary right lobe of the liver lesion. We took out the primary and he got the metastasis resected at the same surgery, which we do sometimes if it's an easy chip shot. This right lobe of the liver, usually a left lobe will be more easily taken out, but we had took out the primary and the met at the same time. He got 6 cycles of FOLFOX, sort of in pseudo-adjuvant, I guess we'd call it, developed neuropathy and discontinued treatment. This is a few years ago. And he went almost 2.5 years without evidence of cancer, but developed a right lower lobe pulmonary nodule with a negative workup otherwise. So we didn't know if this was a met or a primary. So a new pulmonary nodule, you'd always treat it as a new primary, as a solitary. We took him to surgery and it was a small colon met. And he really didn't want any adjuvant therapy. And so after 2.5 years, seemed reasonable to leave him alone. Then about, I think, 8 or 10 months later, he developed a few liver lesions and lung lesions. And so at that point, we started chemotherapy. He got FOLFIRI Bev for almost a year. And when I do that, let's say we go every 3 or 4 weeks with FOLFIRI, he had stable disease, but ultimately had an anastomotic recurrence. And he came back to us at that point, and we took him to surgery. I think the message here, this patient lived, I think, 5 or 6 years from his primary diagnosis. And the message is always remember that these patients, if they recur systemically, the reason I chose to talk about this case is when patients progress systemically, go back and look at the primary, because it's not unusual that they'll progress in the primary as well as systemically, and that's what he did. And again, that's always a caveat, these patients who live a long time. He was back in the community. We'd forgotten, actually, frankly, hadn't recommended that they do colonoscopy. I hadn't thought of it. And the idea that patients who live with colon cancer for a long time really can live amazingly long time, but you should be on the lookout for local recurrence. And so that's, I think, the message there. Similarly, in patients where we leave the primaries in place up front, doesn't mean you just forget about the patients. Even in the study that McCahill published on showing the safety of leaving primaries in place in patients treated with FOLFOX-BEV, I think 20% or 18% of patients needed emergent surgery. So you can leave the primary in place at the outset, but if patients are doing very well, think about the primary because you'd like to take it out on your schedule rather than when they obstruct. Then they're usually left with an ostomy of some sort, and it's not a great situation.
What's the current situation with this patient?
This guy, you know, he's not doing so well. He had low volume disease, right, except for his primary. So we took him and resected his primary. He did not respond. He's had maybe marginal response or stable disease on the current chemotherapy. We went back to FOLFOX because it had been a better part of 3 years or 4 years since he'd had oxaliplatin. Interestingly, didn't develop any neuropathy, but he's maybe, I'd say, metastable disease. Again, this is an example of a patient who's done remarkably well almost without our interventions. I mean, essentially, surgery is about all we've done for him with a little bit of chemotherapy. And this is the biology of the disease. You can cherry pick these patients, and he's 6 years out.
How is he doing on the cetuximab?
Well, so the problem is he didn't get a rash. So he's a very informed guy, and his doctor in the community was planning to do the Everest deal, was planning to dose escalate the cetuximab to try to get him a rash. And that's where we stood. I recommended against that because I don't know how much marginal benefit he'll get. And I should also say that he's got low volume disease. We took the primary out. He's got a few mets and, in fact, is not threatened by his volume of metastatic disease. But once they get on the merry-go-round of chemotherapy being aggressive, that's where they are now. To me, this is a patient who was 6 or 7 years out. I would have liked to hold off until there was something really cool to do, maybe figure out how to get checkpoint inhibitors to work in non-MSI patients, for example. But this patient is on treatment. Be interesting for me, I think at some point he'll probably opt off the treatment and how well he does just by if we leave him alone after that.
So final question, you mentioned something I was going to actually ask you about before, which is the issue of checkpoint inhibitors and non-MSI high colorectal cancer. Anything new and exciting there?
Well, so no. I really thought by now we'd have the results of the atezolizumab cobimetinib randomized study that has not matured yet. The data is not available yet. Don't know what that means. I would suspect it may mean that there was no benefit to the experimental arm, but I don't know that. That was the lead strategy that was in place. Otherwise, I think we really haven't figured out how to make patients who are MSS look, make the immune system think, or make checkpoint inhibitors think they're MSI. So that's a lot of work to do. That's where we have to make progress because, right, I mean, the checkpoint inhibitors are great, but that's for 3 or 4 or 5% of patients with colon cancer, and we've got to do a lot better than that.
I was really surprised and interested to see that combination of a checkpoint inhibitor with a MEK inhibitor. I mean, it looked, I guess, in a single-arm study, you know, maybe it was going to be useful.
That was one of those studies that was in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I did not think it looked very promising. I didn't take care of any patients on the study, though. People who had patients on the study really thought they worked. I confess that we've had a couple of people who elected to opt for that combination off study, and they've not done well. My N of 2 have not done well.
What's the thinking there? I was really surprised to see that combination.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's a certain part of the thinking is, of course, is the whack-a-mole idea that if you can block different pathways, you can turn off the sort of cycling and turn off the feedback loop. I think that as we get into these combination cycle inhibitors, I think a little bit of we're kidding ourselves to some extent because it's as if the cartoons we draw about the orderly pathway, the nodes from RAF to RAS, you know, in the downstream events, as if that's sort of really etched in stone. So I do think that probably different combination biologics will impact some patients, but I really am not all that positive about that or a lot of these other ideas. I think what we see even in the BRAF, where we know we have an inhibitor of the BRAF, it has some effect in some patients and it's not durable. So it's way more complicated than it would need to be for these simple combinations to work.